this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, May 2nd, 2010, and this is show number 258. Well, this week I had the great enjoyment of serving on the advisory board for the Santa Monica College Computer Science Department. Participating in this advisory board for the last couple of years has given me a great appreciation for the quality of Santa Monica College. The idea of the advisory board is to bring together people from industry with the instructors from the college to help them develop their strategic directions. You can imagine what fun I had at this. Basically, they want me to pontificate along with my peers for a couple of hours. They even feed us breakfast. What a blast. The reason I bring this up is because I wanted to give you a little bit of the advice I gave to the college, and I'm curious what you think about it. We talked a lot about languages to teach, and I pushed them to actually make sure students take a variety of languages rather than specializing in just one. Since this is a two-year college, which prepares students for the university, I feel it's important to get them used to the idea of changing languages instead of getting stuck in their ways. You know, they could teach them to be Flash developers, and by the time they get out of school, HTML5 is the technology of the hour. Teaching them to be adaptable and understand the basics of structured programming will benefit them more than anything else they could teach them. I also suggested that every single class they teach should have a fundamental layer embedded in every course. That fundamental layer should include a discussion of three things: ethics, security, and accessibility. I don't think these should really be separate courses. I think they need to be the basis of discussion throughout all of their coursework. As you're developing a GUI, you should be asking them, what have you done to make sure this is accessible? What standards have you followed to be certain of that? You're designing a database. What protections against buffer overflow have been taken? How about your program is due Tuesday night at 8 p.m., but your history paper is due at the same time, and you're offered a copy of a program from a previous year? What do we do? What would be the security implications of using that stolen, borrowed, copied program? You see where I'm going with this? You could bring these things up in every single class, and then they get a better fundamental understanding of these things. One of the other gentlemen on the advisory board said that no one will listen to you discuss security until they've been bitten personally, but I absolutely disagree. I work for a company that has a safety minute at the beginning of every staff meeting, and you can bet it's in the back of my mind, even if I'm mocking the story of the person falling down the stairs during the staff meeting, next time I'm in the stairwell, I'm holding on to that handrail, no question about it. Having these discussions of ethics, security, and accessibility will ensure that the students at least think about it when they're working if it's reinforced so early in their education. Last week, I had a great time with Down a Blind Alley with Shane Jackson. I got a ton of email and comments on how much fun Shane is and how much people learn from him. I had a blast. Well, this week I got a letter from Dr. Robert Carter telling me about a podcast he does called The Tech Doctor, hosted at dr-carter.com. See, it's Dr. Carter. Sort of like Shane was talking about, I could say Drive Carter. It's so confusing. Anyway, there's a link in the show notes, and I've also given you the link to it in iTunes. Turns out he's a friend of Shane's who's also blind, and he does The Tech Doctor with his co-host, Jenny Axler, who's blind as well. Jenny has a fabulous voice. In their most recent show, they did a detailed comparison between the iPad and the iPhone/iPod Touch from the perspective of a blind user. The episode is entitled, Does Size Matter? iPad versus iPod. I listened to the entire show, and I was hooked. The two of them work together as though they've been doing this for years, even though this is episode 2. The comparison of the iPad versus iPod is fascinating from a blind perspective. Remember I asked Shane whether the giant size actually makes it harder to find things? Well, in their podcast, they explain how it is harder in some ways, and it's vastly easier in other ways. I really encourage you to give their show a listen. I hope they do a lot more episodes because it's on my top pick list for sure now.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Drew asked a dumb question as a comment on the blog, and I think it's probably one a few others might have, so it fits our qualifying definition of Dumb Question Corner. His dumb question was, is there any way to use Twitter without having an account? I hate joining things. If it's possible, what benefits are to be had? Well, this took me a while to think about. There's a couple of things you can do without signing up. First, you can just go to twitter.com and don't log in. Just search for topics or people. I guess you'd have to know their Twitter names, though. It's a little hard to do it otherwise. If you're interested in the people I'm interested in, you could simply go over to podfeet.com and look on the right-hand side column and read the tweets on the right-hand side there. You can see what all of the Mac Roundtable folks are saying and everyone from the live chat room. It's sort of a focused subject area, though, so you wouldn't get a broad view of what Twitter's all about. Here's another idea. You could also look for trending topics. It's sort of a what's everyone talking about kind of thing. And one of the places you can find that is at tweetstats.com/trends. I know there's lots of trending topic sites, so that's not the only one. If you do that, though, you're missing a lot. You're not contributing, so you won't get nearly as much out of it as if you shared your thoughts and ideas, too. Perhaps the above suggestions will prompt you to want to participate more. Now, Doug from Wisconsin sent in a much tougher dumb question. This one took me a while. He says, maybe you covered this, but in your review of any software, you require that it solves a problem you have. What problem does the iPad solve for you that required you to purchase? Oh, yeah, that's a tough question because I didn't really need it. It didn't solve a problem right off the bat. But this kind of made me do some real soul searching all week long. Was the problem that I had too much money in my pocket, or that perhaps my purse was too light? All right, I have to go a little deeper than that. One of my goals is to find out for you what problem it might solve for normal people, even if it doesn't solve that problem for me in particular. Now, I define normal people as those who don't carry a laptop with them obsessively everywhere they go, just in case a computing opportunity might break out. I am that obsessive. I've been known to take a laptop to a soccer tournament, you know, just in case. It's always in my trunk, you know, during a 4th of July party. That's just how I am. That's not normal. Now, I do include people in normal who would enjoy a little bit of computing from time to time, but a regular laptop isn't at all practical to carry around for them. For those normal people, I think they'd be much more likely to toss an iPad into their bag. I find I'll grab the iPad when I just want to look something up quickly. Or let's say I'm going to walk over to Steve's office to show him something. Even though my laptop is sitting right there on my desk in my office, I'll grab the iPad because it's just so darn portable. One of the reasons it's portable is that you can't really hook it up to anything. My laptop, when it's in my office, is tethered to a big monitor, USB devices like a mouse, and of course power because the battery life is about 15 minutes. The iPad, on the other hand, can't connect to anything at all, and its battery life is all day long, so it's so much easier to just grab and go. Now, I thought I would watch a lot of video on it, but to move video podcast to it, I have to tether it to my laptop. So then it's kind of like, why not just watch it on my laptop? My laptop's right there. I'm experimenting with just watching from websites. Got to get a good workflow going there, though. I'm not about to just go to every site one by one. That kind of defeats the whole idea of video podcasting. In listening to the Nightcast episode KC0035, Life in a Browser, Nightwise suggests using Google Reader as a podcast aggregator, so I'm going to give that a try. Today I went through and I looked up a whole bunch of my video podcasts I like, looked up their URLs for their RSS feeds, and I stuffed them all into Google Reader, so I'm going to try that next week. Now that I have the 3G model of the iPad, I don't have to think that far ahead because it can pull it for me anytime I need it. A problem it doesn't solve is video playback on a projector via the expensive VGA adapter. That is, unless you're willing to rip your own content from DVDs rather than using the legally downloaded iPod versions from the movie's manufacturer. You may have heard of an annoying technology called HDCP, also known as High Bandwidth Digital Content Protection. This protection does not protect you at all. It was designed to protect the interests of the movie companies. Now, here's how it works. I bought the movie Up on Blu-ray DVD, and it came with a digital download for the iPod. I put Up on my iPad, and it was positively gorgeous. I use it as my demo for the amazing screen quality on the iPad, plus it's a great movie. Here's the great part, though. I plugged in my VGA adapter to a projector, and I get a message saying, you can't play that movie. Yep, because I legally own this movie, I can't play it. But if I'd stolen it, I'd be able to play it. Isn't that lovely? I like that a lot. Well, if you're a voracious reader, it's a lot easier to carry around a pound and a half iPad than a dozen books on vacation. It weighs less than a single hardback book. Steve actually tested that. So if you're like my friend Darlene, who reads several books a week from the library, The iPad solves a huge problem here. Of course, there's other ebook readers who do this too, but the iPad does it quite beautifully. Here's an odd little problem it solves. I'm frequently in meetings with a couple people around a table where we scribble on paper, drawing diagrams to explain our points. In my office, I always have a pile of scratch paper I dig out of the recycling bin next to the printer. See, I have to go to the printer to get it because I don't print hardly ever myself anymore, so I don't generate enough scratch paper to keep myself in stock. But anyway, when I'm in someone else's office, I'm always digging through their trash looking for something to write on, and I can't bring myself to actually use store-bought pads of paper. That just seems so inefficient. Enter the iPad with applications like Adobe Ideas and Penultimate. Links are in the show notes to both of those. They're both pretty good at letting you just draw and write with your finger. Portable whiteboard! Well, I'm sure I'll come up with more problems over time, but for now, that's a pretty good start. Thanks for the challenging question, Doug. That really made me think. If any of you have a real problem the iPad solves for you, let me know and I'll talk about it in the show. I blather on every week about how I personally use ScreenSteps to do documentation, but I thought this week I'd tell you about someone else's experience. Judy Son is Vice President of Operations at the Colorectal Cancer Coalition. Boy, that's hard to say, and that's why they call it C3. This is a nonprofit organization. You know, in a nonprofit, you can't be wasting a single dime on anything that doesn't have to be spent, and everyone's time is very precious. At C3, they use a variety of web application services like Google Apps, Salesforce, and Box. And it always seems to fall to Judy to teach people how to use these tools. She found she was spending a ton of time answering the same questions over and over again, so she started trying to make up lessons using a word processor with screenshots. But it took her a long time because the process was so tedious and she hated doing it. It would take her 2 days to turn around an answer for someone. You can tell where the story's going, of course. She got screen steps, and now her turnaround time is around 10 minutes. She sounds like my kind of people. In the in-depth article about Judy's experiences over on BlueMangoLearning.com, she says, "What used to take me a day of dread when I got around to it is now, ooh, fun! I get to create a lesson." In a way that only a geek can appreciate that it's actually fun. I learned a lot reading this article, like how Judy uses Google Sites to post her lessons. I need to look into that and learn how to do it. Sounds like something I need. Mine are kind of jumbled all over on the website. If you'd like to have as much fun as Judy and me and look like a brilliant superstar to your coworkers, families, bosses, and friends, check out ScreenSteps over at ScreenSteps.com. And after you check out their free 30-day trial, be sure to use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price of ScreenSteps Desktop. Matt Rinesmith, also known as Platnicat on Twitter, gives us another review of a Twitter client for Linux.
Hi, Allison. This is another review of another Linux Twitter client. This time, it's called Quit. Now, first of all, I should probably explain the reasoning behind doing this review. It's simple. My previous Twitter client, Pino, which I also reviewed on the NoZillaCast, for whatever reason, in its current version, is very unstable on my laptop. Now, according to numerous other sources I've heard from, this stability issue is not a problem on every computer that you're going to run into. So, don't base your choice of a Twitter client based purely on which client is stable on my laptop. However, on my laptop, as it was very unstable, I decided to look into other Twitter clients, and the first one I decided to try was Quit. So, what does it do? Well, you'd be hard-pressed to find something Quit doesn't do, because some of its basic features are URL shortening, tweet pic uploading, separate tabs for home, public, replies, favorite tweets, inbox on direct messages, outbox on direct messages, and doing a Twitter search. Now, when you open the settings, you can find a number of neat things, such as the ability to use several accounts of different types, such as identity.ca, I've never understood that service actually, Twitter, and custom, which I have never actually tried. There is a choice of URL shorteners, including u.nu, my favorite because it has the shortest URLs you're ever going to find, bit.ly, budurl.com, clck.ru, j.mp, migre.me, murl.kztr.im, and uiop.me. Under connection, you have a choice to configure proxy settings. And under user interface, you can choose how often it updates, which tabs it shows, whether those tabs auto-update. You can change what it says above the tweet box. This, in my case, I changed to OK tweet here. You can have it show how many characters are left. You can configure how many messages it shows in a page. You can also configure how many messages it shows in the pop-up when you hover over the tray icon. You can change the retweet tag. Great if you use Pino and you love that little recycle symbol. You can also change the color of the boxes the tweets show up in. This is actually kind of difficult to explain, so I'll add a screenshot to the show notes so that you can see what it looks like. So, what are my impressions? Well, overall I like it. It is a very nice client in terms of features, and overall it performs fairly well on my system. That is, so I thought. Then I tried to start browsing the web using Firefox, and also check my email using Thunderbird. And once I did these two tasks at the same time, normally they performed quite admirably, well, it kind of started to fall apart. I was wondering why, so I opened my system monitor, and I discovered why. Why, you ask? Well, because Qwik was using 235 megabytes of RAM. And on my 1 gig system, that was just too much. Now, I suppose if you have a system with a huge amount of RAM, Qwik's great for you. But since I have a very limited amount, I decided to pass on it. So, what's my final verdict? Large amount of RAM? Go for it. It's the best Twitter client for Linux you're going to find. Not a lot of RAM? Pass this one up. Don't worry, I have another one I'm reviewing next week. Anyway, thanks for listening to this review on the NoSilicast, and bye!
Thanks, Matt. I always like your reviews. You give us a well-rounded description of the tool itself, how you'd like to use it, and whether it actually lives up to its promise. I'm looking forward to your next Linux Twitter client. So far, the last one you gave us, I think it was called Pino, is working really well for me in Ubuntu. Speaking of Ubuntu, don't forget to tell me how to upgrade to 10.04. I heard it just came out. You know you've signed on as my personal Ubuntu tech support for the rest of your life, right? Well, how about yet another listener review?
This is David Allen from Mac 20 Questions, which you can find at answer20q.com. Here I have a review of a iPhone or iPad application called GoodReader and a mention of a to-do app that links to it. Here is a problem to be solved. Move files onto the iPad, iPhone or iPod Touch and to be able to manipulate them. And to be able to manipulate folders. A proposed solution here could be GoodReader. And it's great for reading documents like PDFs and iWork files. Lifehacker said, GoodReader seems like a nice alternative for those who want to read PDF-based ebooks and other texts on their iPhone or iPad and don't quite need to convert them to the EPUB ebooks format. GoodReader has the ability to have very large PDF files, including password-protected ones, very large text files, high-resolution pictures and other graphic files, including a slideshow viewing mode. Nice. All file formats that are supported by the Safari engine, so Microsoft Office files, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, HTML files and Safari web archives. Of course, it'll do iWork 08 and 09 files, Pages, Numbers and Keynote, although the files must be saved with the Include Preview option. .ai files from Illustrator, if they're saved with the PDF compatible option, can also be viewed, as can audio files and video files that are supported by the iPhone operating system. I found it easy to move the files onto my iPhone using the Bonjour connection over Wi-Fi. All you have to do is to go to Connect to Server in Finder or use Command K, that'll do the same. Put in the details that you will see in the app on the iPad, iPhone or iPod Touch, and when you've got it set up, all you have to do is drag and drop. You have to keep the app open in the mobile device while doing this, of course. You can also do web downloads and access files from WebDAV servers, So you've got MobileMe, iDisk, Box.net, FilesAnywhere.com and others. You can also manage files and folders by pressing the action button in a file list view. There is a set of buttons at the bottom of the screen that give you your options. With nothing selected, you can select all, create a new folder, create a new text file. When you create a new text file, it puts in there whatever you have on the clipboard. Quite useful, I suppose. It's then possible to go in and edit the text file after that, of course. When I started GoodReader, I wondered why it didn't change from landscape to portrait mode. And then I found the button at the bottom to manually switch orientation. Then I found later that there is a switch in the settings that allow auto-rotation using the accelerometer. So all bases are covered there. There is a good zoom, which was great with a PDF I was looking at with small diagrams in it. In fact, really small diagrams in it. And I was able to get in really close to be able to see what I wanted to see in there. Nice one. That was very handy. There is password protection for your sensitive data. You can set a password for when you start up the application or set a single password that works on individual files. When you have a file selected, there is a to-do task button in Actions, but you have to have the to-do app from Apigo installed. I have just downloaded the free version of that app to try out, and yes, it does work. I hit the button and it opened to-do, which also looks like an interesting app. To-do has a desktop application that you can sync to, as well as it's been possible to sync to Remember the Milk and Toodled. Not only that, but Text Expander will work with that one too, although Text Expander didn't work with GoodReader. The full version of To-Do costs €8, and I think if I was spending that amount, I would probably get Things as a To-Do application, though. The application GoodReader cost me €0.79, and it was well worth it. There are some paid extras, one being the ability to connect to Google Docs for 99 cents. Although they do say that if you're getting the iPad version, all of those extras are included anyway. I was able to connect to Dropbox and bring in a file. When it was in to GoodReader, it just named the file txt.rtf. So it lost its name when it came in, but all the text was there, and it was read-only. So if I wanted to edit it, I would have to copy all of it to the clipboard and then start a new text document file, and then I could do whatever I wanted with it. I suppose one of the best things about GoodReader is that it's so easy to move files to your mobile device and turn it into storage like a thumb drive with that ability to manage your files and folders. There are many people that are asking for that capability or complaining that it's not available on the iPad, but they've not managed to get their hands on GoodReader yet. So there you go, problem solved. You can follow me on Twitter as Mac20Q. Bye-bye now.
I think the ability to read so many things from web services like Box.net and others is really the compelling part of this software. You basically can have access to all of your text files for only $1. The price on To-Do does sound a bit high at $9.99, but maybe I don't get everything it does yet. That wasn't a lot of information. But GoodReader for $1 for the iPhone or iPad version sounds like a great purchase. By the way, I should tell you there is an app called To-Do with a space between the two and the do from Erica Sadun that's actually free. Maybe I'll give that a try first. I like that they have the Google Reader Lite version for iPhone too, so you can try it out first to see if it's what you need. Since the App Store doesn't let us do shareware yet, this is a great compromise method. Thanks for the review, David. Believe it or not, I've had the same mechanic for my car since 1978. I don't still have the same car since 1978, but I have the same mechanic. His name is Honda Bob, and he actually drives to our house and fixes our cars. Does it right in the driveway while we sit inside. Well, okay, actually, Steve doesn't sit inside. Steve goes outside and bothers Bob, so I'm sure it costs us a little more than it would. But Honda Bob is really patient, likes to teach Steve things, and that is one of the interesting things about Honda Bob is he's a teacher. He has a great website at hdabob.com that I really encourage you to go over and look at, and he's got lessons about everything, just so you get some idea of how the parts of your car work before you go into a mechanic, even if it isn't Honda Bob. I should warn you, Honda Bob only works in the LA and Orange County areas, but he does work on Acuras as well as Hondas. If you fit that criteria and you'd like to sit home while someone worked on your car, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-8000. 2321 or visit his website at hjbob.com. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. What's that time of the week again? It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you today, Bart?
I'm good. You sound funny, Katie.
That was very cool of Katie to stand in. It was. I miss talking to you. I really miss you when you're away, but it was kind of nice having the day off and just to relax and play with my kids and stuff. It was a good time.
Yeah, I always miss everyone on the internet, but especially your good self.
Aw. It's funny, you know, you're already, what, 8,000 miles away, and yet when you go 8,300 miles away, I miss you.
Well, it's more the lack of internets.
Right.
I looked into how much it would be to use data on the iPhone when I was over there.
Yeah?
$4.95 per megabyte, so €5 per megabyte.
Jeez.
But if I paid for 4 megabytes in a day, I get the next 46 of them free that day. So okay. I can have 50 megs for €20.
Which is like $30 or something a day.
So for the week, I could have spent like €140 and gotten like 50 megs of data a day.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So not,
exactly.
All right. Well, we got a lot on the agenda today. We better kick off. Let's, what's shaking in sure. Security Light? Oh, before okay. I forget, good job, Katie, calling you on trying to do a Security Light where there was no solution.
I know. You can't get away with anything on this show.
She was a very good stand-in, I thought.
I had great fun recording with Katie. So I said it to her already, but thank you, Katie, for stepping in. It was much fun.
All right, let's kick off.
Okay, so first up, we have some browsers. For the Windows people only, there's an update to Chrome. And I would like to shoot whoever in Google thought these version numbers were a good idea. You need to be on number 4.1.249.1064.
That reads like a Sony product number, doesn't it?
It sounds across from an IP address and a date.
That's nice. I mean, they couldn't just call it 4.2?
Yeah, nuts. Apparently absolutely not. Nuts. But anyway, it's there were 3 or 4 security issues all rated high. So probably a good one to do. It'll probably happen automatically being Chrome. But if you're worried, check your version number. And if it's that big, long thing, it's in the show notes. Then you're good.
Now, is it bad that we didn't get one too on the Mac, or?
Well, is it officially out on the Mac, or what's the state of play?
That's a good question. Probably not.
I thought it was in beta.
Probably
is. I could be wrong. I lose track of these things.
Right. It's nice to have choices.
True. Then, also browser-based, we have an update from Opera, and this one's for everyone, so Windows and Mac people get to play along, and they have proper version numbers. You need to be on at least version 10.53.
Oh, that's good.
And that fixes some bugs which Opera rate as, quote, extremely serious. Ooh. Sorry, extremely severe. Basically, arbitrary code execution.
Nice.
Which you don't want from web pages.
I remember, we don't like that one. Oh, I did just check. Google Chrome is still beta on the Mac. Well, the version I have anyway is 5.0.342.9 beta.
Okay, so that's significantly higher then, because these are on 4.1.
Yeah.
Point blah, 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 blah.
And it's on automatic update, and it says that's the latest update, so it's all good.
Okay.
So all right.
It may only affect 4.0 versions. Then I also want to do a follow-up. We talked about this before. We talked about it on the 11th of April. I checked the wiki. And it was a link from Adobe themselves on how to turn off the launch functionality that lets PDFs run executables, which is insane.
I believe that was the one that was in the spec, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's become a tad more urgent that you do that because the attacks are happening for real now. People are sending out emails with awfully realistic-looking subjects that people would be most inclined to open the PDF.
Yes.
So absolutely, positively, either remove the Adobe infestation or follow the instructions linked in the show notes again.
And I'd that's URL, Mac and Windows, great. Right?
The instructions, I believe, are Windows only, and the attacks at the moment are Windows only. Now, it's to be honest, there's no reason they couldn't do it against the Mac too, but
your link is to Macworld UK.
Yeah, but it's Macworld UK don't live up to their name.
Or they're broader thinkers. That's good, though. Okay.
Yeah. So the instructions are for Windows only, unfortunately.
All right.
They involve tweaking the registry and such beautiful things.
They probably aren't attacking the Mac in this case because most people just use Preview. So.
Well, yeah. So I guess it's a fairly small attack surface, one hopes.
Okay.
So I just really thought it was important to remind people of that again. I know we had said it before, but since the attacks are now happening for real, you know, definitely, definitely do it.
Okay.
Then the other thing I want to mention is the McAfee problem. And I guess this is, I'm not sure how this fits into security light per se. It's, I want to tell people not to be scared. So I guess that means.
Oh, well, that's okay.
Okay, so what happened, we should say, is that McAfee made a minor boo-boo, a rather major boo-boo, and accidentally pushed out a .dat file, which made their antivirus product recognize svchost.exe in Windows Service Pack Windows XP Service Pack 3 as a virus.
Oh, I
now,
heard about this.
Svchost is rather critical. Basically, if you use the network, you run through svchost.exe. In fact, Windows won't even boot without it. So what would happen is McAfee would find it as a virus, but because it's loaded into the kernel, they couldn't do anything without a reboot. So they'd give you, I think it was 60 seconds notice of a reboot. So if you were really quick, you could stop it and then run some terminal commands and kill it, basically. But if it went ahead and rebooted, it would go ahead and either delete or quarantine the file, depending on your settings. At which point, Windows would try to continue booting and fail miserably and reboot and try again and fail and reboot and try again and fail and reboot, and you get the picture.
Nice. Now, I heard this happened to a hospital, and it went through all of their computers, that for a day they had about 1,000 computers down.
Yeah, this happened, I think, on the day I flew to Belgium. And when I arrived, my uncle was explaining how his wife had gotten home early from work because none of their computers were working.
Oh, my gosh.
She worked in an insurance company, so, I mean, okay, it's annoying, but it's not quite life and death.
Jeez. Yeah, I'm glad the airlines weren't using those tools.
Service Pack 3, yeah.
So it's only on Windows XP Service Pack 3, though. If you've moved on to Windows 7...
You're okay. And if you're bold and are still running Service Pack 2, you're also okay, ironically. And if you don't do your updates of your antivirus definitions, you're okay from this particular problem.
This is kind of sad that using an antivirus is risky.
It is. That is the reality of it. This can happen. This has happened before, and this will happen again. It doesn't happen often, and it happens to all products. It's not that this is just a thing that's happened to McAfee. It happened to Norton before in the past. These things have happened and will happen, and it's just the nature of the game. If you use Windows, this is the price you pay. It is dangerous. It is mildly dangerous to run an AV. It is massively dangerous not to run an AV. So I know people are going to be tempted to make sure this never happens to them again. And their temptation is going to be just to kill the AV.
Or switch AV, right?
Or switch AV. But to be honest, it's a bit like plane crashes. Wasn't it you that said that your dad always flew on the airline that had the most recent accident?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, McAfee are going to be mighty careful now. Because this is a big mess for them to clean up.
Oh, yeah.
Both PR-wise and actual-wise.
That's a good point. So our recommendation is to use McAfee then.
Yeah, for the next couple of months, I'd say McAfee are definitely going to be safer than the others because they're panicked.
Right.
And as far as I'm concerned, for what it's worth, anything is better than Norton.
Yeah.
Once it gets claws into your system, good night. Hate it. So basically, I just wanted to tell anyone who's tempted to run away from AV or to run away from McAfee, stop, think. Yes, it was annoying. Yes, it was terrible. Yes, it could happen again. But the alternatives are worse, and it could happen on any AV. This is not McAfee specific. It just happened to happen to them this time.
Who was it, though, that someone said I heard it said that now having an AV on your machine is as likely to cause you damage as not having it. You disagree with that?
I find that hard to believe. Now, I know some security gurus run without AV, people like Steve Gibson and stuff, but he's an expert. He's allowed to cross the tightrope without a safety net.
Yeah, a lot of my expert friends also don't run AV, but I don't think, I mean, anybody who's on XP Service Pack 3 is probably not in the category I'd call an expert.
I mean, if you really know what you're at, you can run without AV. But really, for a home computer, or indeed for a work computer, I don't think it's a sensible option.
Right, I agree. All right,
so
we've eaten our vegetables.
I just thought it was important to stop people running in panic.
All right, good. Well, our top topic of the day is going to be. I asked Bart to try to explain to me yet one more time, even though I've asked this of about 14 people, and my buddy Ron got me the closest to actually understanding this. I have this really nice fancy pants digital SLR, and I keep it on the automatic programming setting all the time. And it's not that I don't understand the math behind things like aperture and shutter priority and all that kind of stuff. It's that I don't know how to do it. Like, I'm sitting there, I got a flower in front of me. I don't know. If I put on the little flower on the dial, it comes out pretty good. That's all I know how to do.
That's not bad, actually. I slightly morphed your topic into a fairly wordy blog post. I didn't do a word count on it, but the scroll bar is very wee.
But well written.
Thank you. Basically, the way I look at it is, when you get your camera first, you're intimidated by it because digital SLRs have lots of buttons. And they have scary... A lot of them don't even have any words on them. They just have pictures. And you get scared, and the first thing you do is put it to auto when you start taking pictures, and hey, look, there's pictures.
And they come out better than the other camera you had, so you're happy.
Yeah, but if you actually want to get the use out of the digital camera, you need to wean yourself off auto and get to the stage where you're in control and not the camera. So at auto, the camera has 100% of control, and you have none apart from where you point it. And in full manual, the camera has no control, and you have all the control. And then in between, there's actually quite a few levels where you can share control, giving maybe more to you or more to the camera, depending on what you're comfortable with. So there's a sort of a logical progression through the modes. And I thought we might just look at that.
Okay.
And I also think it's very important before we do that, that we lay out the basics really carefully so that people understand what we're talking about. Now, I know you understand the basics, so you're going to be
I'll sit here quietly and politely. Well, that's not too bloody likely, but
we can try. Ultimately,
politely, we'll shoot for a realizable goal at least.
The theory hasn't changed since 1838 when the first camera was invented. You have some form of something that is sensitive to light. You put light on it and a picture comes out. Depending on how sensitive it is, you need more or less light. If it's very sensitive, a little bit of light will do the trick. If it's not very sensitive, lots of light is needed.
Okay.
Ultimately, that's what it's all about. So the first thing is, how do we measure sensitivity? We use something called the ISO, or ISO, scale. And bigger the number, more sensitive. Lower the number, less sensitive. For some reason, it used to be called ASA when I was younger. Or rather, when my parents were younger and I was reading their old photography books. But it's now called ISO. Same scale.
For a while, it was called both. I didn't understand that, but okay.
Yeah. Anyway, I could explain, but I won't.
Good.
So in the days of film, you would buy a roll of film and it had a certain sensitivity and you would put in that roll of film and then for the entire time you're using that film, you had no choice but to use that sensitivity. On a digital camera, you have a little dial and you can just change the ISO. But you're not really changing the ISO, you're cheating. So the actual physical sensor, the little chip that catches the light, actually has an ISO. It's called its base ISO. And what you can do is you can multiply the light you collect by 2 or 4 or 8 or 16 or 32, etc. And that gives you higher and higher ISOs.
Okay.
But the price you pay is noise. So if you actually want to get the nicest photo out of your digital SLR camera, you should always use it as its native ISO. Its native ISO will be written in the manual and it will be on the internet. For your camera, which is the same as my camera, it's 200.
So I was never a fan of going up in higher ISOs on my other cameras, buying when I had an SLR, but I could buy film. I hated the noise. I just don't even want to go there. I don't want a photograph that's got noise in it. Forget it. Don't want to do it. Well, no interest. I don't even want the picture.
In film, it was grain, and in digital, it's noise. But it actually looks awfully similar.
Okay, little dots.
Yeah, icky dots.
So I'd like to stick with just, okay, if it's 200, fine. Isn't there also an auto setting?
There is an auto setting, which is where you let the camera decide.
Okay. So can we just leave that part alone?
We can even offer that. The important thing to know is that the ISO determines how much light you need for the picture to work. High ISO, less light. Low ISO, more light. So in order to get a proper photograph, your ISO tells you how much light you need, so you need to get that much light in. And we control how much light comes in two ways. We can control how long the light hits the sensor. So the longer it hits the sensor, the more light it collects.
Mm-hmm.
That's our shutter speed. And we measure that in inverse seconds. What, pray tell, does Bart mean by an inverse second?
Everything's upside down land on cameras. That's what I figured.
It is, actually. So when your camera, when your digital camera says 200, what it means is 1/200th of a second.
Right.
And when it says 500, it means 1/500th of a second. So big numbers are shorter time.
Okay. Because
a 500th is less than a 200th, is less than a quarter. So that's just, it makes people weird, but that's actually what it's measuring in. It's in inverse seconds.
We can deal with that.
We can deal with that.
So far, I'm with you.
Messing with the exposure time has the effect of letting in more or less light, but it also has a second effect, and that's that it affects how things that move look. So if something is moving and you have a really short shutter speed, then you will freeze the action. And if you have a really short shutter speed, you'll actually be able to see things that your eye can't see. Your eye will just see a blur, but the camera can't. It can see, you know, the camera can freeze it, which is great. Or you can go the other way and set a long exposure time, and then everything that's moving is blurred. So if something, you know, you hold the camera still and something moves through your field, that'll be blurred. Or you can move the camera with the moving object and get the moving object sharp and everything behind it blurry.
Okay.
But long exposure, blurry, short exposure, freeze motion. So if you're playing around with motion, then you care about what the shutter speed is. The second thing we can control, we use to control how much light hits the sensor so that we get to the required amount, is how big of a hole there is between the outside world and the sensor. Big hole lets in lots of light. Little hole lets in very little light. Now, yet again, so when you mess with the ISO, you get a side effect of noise. When you mess with the exposure time, you get a side effect of how it affects moving things. And when you mess with the aperture, you also get a side effect, which is how much of what you see is in focus. Really big hole means that you get... it's caused by diffraction, if you care about the physics. But it means basically that there's very little of the scene actually in focus. So there's a thin strip in focus wherever you happen to be focusing. If you focus on someone's eyes, their eyes will be in focus, but their nose mightn't be, and the back of their head certainly isn't.
So one of the ways I help people remember that one is if you wear glasses at all, you remember when you first had to get glasses, you'd say things like, oh, I only have to use them to drive at night. And the reason for that is when it's dark out, the aperture of your eyeball, your pupil, opens up, which gives you a very shallow depth of field, so you can't see things at different distances particularly well. So that's a perfect example. The aperture's open really wide. You've got a real shallow depth of field that's really bad for driving, but could be fun for taking pictures of, say, flowers.
Hmm, exactly. So narrow hole lets in very little light, but it gives a really deep depth of field. So if you want to take a landscape with like a rock in the foreground, a tree in the midground, and some mountains in the background, you want lots of things in focus.
Right, right, right.
You need to have a really small hole. Now, how we measure the hole is yet another one of those upside-down world measurements, as you've called them. I'm not going to go into the math, but we use something called the focal ratio, or F number. So we'd say F8. It's written as F/8, but we just say F8. And all you need to remember, small focal ratio, big hole, shallow depth of field. Big focal ratio, small hole, big depth of field.
Okay, maybe I'm too much of a mathematician, but I can't understand what a big or small ratio is, because F over 8 is like saying 1/8. That's a small number, but F over 22, that's an even smaller number. Do you mean that's a small ratio or a big ratio if I say F22?
Okay, pretend the F/ are one symbol, because it doesn't mean F over 8, it means F8.
Oh.
It's badly written.
Well,
I didn't make this stuff
up. But it's a ratio. So it is
a ratio,
over.
But the ratio is expressed as a fraction. So hence you have F1.4. Anyway,
okay.
All
I'm
you
lost.
Need to know.
I'm lost.
I'm sorry, I didn't make up this terminology. F1.4 is a very low focal ratio, which means you get loads and loads of light but very, very little depth of field. Now, f1.4 is really low. You might get a lens with f1.2, but really you're not realistically you're going to ever get a smaller number than 1.4 or 1.2. You'd be lucky to get 1.8, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And on the kit lens that comes with our camera, you only get to 3.5.
Yeah, so the smaller that number is, which he's calling a bigger... No, you're calling it a smaller ratio, right? A 1.4...
It's a smaller ratio, so it's a smaller number.
Okay. The smaller that number is, the more money just left your pocket.
That is pretty true, actually.
So, I bought Lindsay an f1.8 lens, and it was $200 cheaper than the 1.4 lens I wanted to get her. I mean, it was literally
difference. Yeah, you got the 1.4, though, just like me.
Right, but that had gone up $200 in price since we bought it, so we got a really good deal when we bought them. So by the time I turned around to buy hers, I went, ooh, look, f1.8, that's good.
It's good enough, yeah.
Right.
On the other end of the scale, you have f64 would be considered a very small aperture, so it's physically a very small hole or a very big focal ratio.
Okay.
So most lenses won't go to f64.
Okay.
So that, just to give you an idea of the ranges, but really what we care about is that if we have a low number, lots of light gets in, but we don't have a lot in focus. If we have a high number, very little light gets in, but we've lots of stuff in focus.
Okay.
So you have to put it all together. The ISO determines how much light you need, and the combination of aperture and exposure determine how much you get. So to get a properly exposed photograph, you have to balance those three things.
Okay.
When you change one, you knock it out of balance, so you have to change something else to compensate.
Which basically means we have three-dimensional space to choose from. So I can't take a picture and put it back on auto.
Well, yeah, it's exactly, because you're going straight from camera do everything to, okay, now I've just learned everything, which doesn't work.
So you're going to take us slowly into that scary land?
So if you pick up your camera, I conveniently have mine next to me.
Yes, I brought mine next to me, so everyone put the show on pause, go get your camera.
So there's a dial on the top, whether it's a Canon or a Nikon, it doesn't matter. They all have these dials at the top.
Or Fuji,
tell you what
or
mode
whoever.
You're in.
Or Fuji or whoever.
Yeah, whatever. There's going to be, if it's a digital SLR, there's going to be a dial to choose the mode. And auto is by far the easiest. You put it on auto, you point it at something, you click the shutter and you have a photo.
I'm good
at that. It'll be a snapshot.
And I take snapshots.
But it will be a photo. Because basically the camera has to make decisions about the ISO, the aperture and the exposure, and all it really cares about is getting those three to make a picture that works. And it really has no idea artistically what you mean. So it doesn't know whether you want a shallow depth of field or whether you want some blur. So you tend to end up with sort of average shots. You try to get motion blur on a car, but there isn't quite enough blur. You try to take pictures of someone playing football, but there's too much blur. You try to take a portrait, but there's too much in focus. You try to take a landscape, there's not enough in focus. So you end up sort of, the camera just averages everything and says, middle ground. Yeah, but that's not what you want. So the first step is simply to let the camera still do all the work, but just give it a hint as to what you mean. So, you know, you're not taking any real control, you're just giving it a pointer. And those are all the icons. So you have auto and then you have a bunch of letters, we'll get to the letters later. But other than that, you have icons. And so a very common one is the little flower. It's usually a tulip for some reason. I don't know why tulips won that little competition. But it's pretty much always a stylized tulip. That's the so-called macro mode. And that means that if you try to take a picture of something small but close, like a butterfly or a flower, it will pick an aperture and an exposure that should work well for that kind of scene. Another common one is a little running man. That's your sport setting. And what that means is it will make sure, no matter what else it has to do to make that possible, it will choose a very quick shutter speed. It's probably going to have to use a wide aperture, and it's probably going to have to resort to a high ISO, especially if it starts to get evening time as you're taking your pictures of your kids playing football or whatever. But it's going to do everything it can by making as many sacrifices in the other areas to keep the shutter speed short.
You know what's really sad is I took upwards of 300 photographs per cross-country or track meet, and I never knew I should have changed that setting. I have a bunch of really blurry photos at dusk, and if I'd known about that, I could have had it, at least grainy shots at dusk that were in maybe more less blur.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's always a compromise. The art of photography is in choosing the compromise. So you have the choice of either blur or noise, and you're better off having a noisy shot where your subject is actually recognizable than a really clean shot with no noise of nothing.
Because I throw those away.
Exactly. Then you will also have usually something that looks like a mountain would be your landscape setting. So that will make sure to keep the aperture as high as it can so that the hole is physically very small so everything's in focus. Because there's no point having a landscape where your tree in the foreground is fuzzy. You want that sharp, and you want the lake sharp, and you want the mountain sharp, and you want the clouds sharp. You want it all sharp. So the mountain setting will make it say, okay, no matter what else I have to do to make it possible, I'm going to keep that aperture to a high F number, i.e. a small physical hole. And if that means I have to go into half-second exposures or all these kind of city things, I'm going to do it because I absolutely, positively need to keep the focal ratio high. There's also going to be one that looks like a woman with a hat, which is your portrait mode.
Ah, okay.
And that will try to keep your depth of field really shallow. So it's kind of the inverse of the landscape mode.
Oh, okay.
Whatever it has to do to keep the F number low so that there's a big hole so you get really shallow depth of field.
Okay, got it.
And then the nighttime one is usually a person with a star. Or a star or something like that. And that will just ramp up the ISO and do its best to work with a high ISO.
So the one that always confuses me on our dial is we have a little kid.
I have no idea what the kid does. I have absolutely, positively no idea.
What could it do? I mean, it's got to be somewhere between a lovely shallow depth of field and moving really fast.
Maybe it's both. Maybe it tries to do both, but it just lets the ISO go mad.
Right.
I don't know. I really have no idea. I think it's a kid. It looks like Cartman.
Okay. So I'm embarrassed to say I hardly ever use those. I do always put it on the macro mode, but then I have a frequent, when I take pictures of flowers, but then I frequently forget to change it. And my photos still look kind of okay.
They look kind of okay, but if you tried to use the flower to take pictures of your sports, you'd have a problem.
Okay.
So if you do nothing else, if you take nothing else away from this entire discussion, then using those icons, it will improve your photography a lot.
Okay.
And that's not hard.
Okay, take us off the bunny slope now.
Yeah, you haven't really taken control away from the camera. You're just giving it some pointers. So the first step to taking just a little bit of control is the program mode, or P. I'm reminded somewhat of a saying by Scott Bourne that P does not stand for perfect, but we'll leave that aside. In program mode, it will still do the same as in auto, except a couple of features become available to you to play with. You can choose your own ISO, for example, which you just can't do in auto. If you put the camera in auto, you don't have the option to change the ISO. If you put it in program, at least you can say, look, I really want to keep the ISO at 200. I'm fed up with all this grain. And then it will do its best to deal with that. You can also do things like, if you want, start manually setting the white balance and those kind of things, or manually decide when to flash and when not to flash. So the program mode still does the exposure and the aperture automatically, but it does begin to give you a little more control over some of the other things.
Okay.
I don't use it, though.
So let's go past that one.
Because what actually matters is that you start to take control of the artistic aspects of the photo. And 99% of the time, the artistic aspect of the photo is the depth of field. So most of the time, what you actually care about to get the nicer photograph is controlling the aperture. So what you want to do is you want to take control of the aperture, but let the camera worry about compensating by changing the shutter speed. Now, you can choose auto ISO on aperture priority mode, which is the letter A, which means that you have taken responsibility for the aperture. You can choose to also take responsibility for the ISO if you want. You don't have to. You can still leave it on auto ISO. But the camera will then compensate for your choices by messing with the shutter speed.
Okay, let's start with that.
So that's
because I'm going to use this because I want to take a really nice shallow depth of field photo.
Yes.
So I want to force it down to its lowest aperture.
You may want to, or you may be taking a picture of a butterfly and your first instinct is, I want a shallow depth of field because that looks good.
Mm-hmm.
And so you take the picture with the shallowest possible depth of field and you realize that although his eyeballs are in focus, the tip of his wing isn't. In fact, halfway up his wing isn't even in focus.
Because you've been highly successful at getting a low aperture.
You've been highly successful at getting a low aperture and lo and behold, it's actually too low. So then you start to ease it back. and you say, okay, I want low, but obviously not F1.4. Maybe F2. Take another shot. Have a look. Better. Actually, just I'll cut
okay,
to the chase.
Okay, this is the hard part.
Good
right
butterflies
here.
F8.
Okay, but this is a hard part. I don't know. I set it to F1.4 and I take a picture. What am I looking for that's going to be wrong or right, and how do I change it?
Okay.
What do I do next?
What you're controlling is the depth of field. So you literally look at it and you go, is what I want to be in focus, all of it in focus?
But let's say it's too dark or too light. Let's say it was the right depth of field, but it's too bright.
Well, that could only happen if something has hit the limit. So the camera is going to adjust the shutter speed to compensate for everything you do, but the laws of physics eventually kick in.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And at that point, the camera will flash a warning. You'll see it in the viewfinder. It'll start flashing a warning sign at you. If you see something flashing in the viewfinder, you've hit the wall. So that means you've got to dial back, and you just keep twiddling that dial until it stops flashing at you.
But which way? I mean, seriously, let's say I put it at F8 and it's too bright. What do I do next?
That's not going to happen. F8 is middle of the road.
Okay.
That's just physically not going to happen.
Okay, whatever. I pick some number and it's too bright because I let in too much light.
But you're not. If you're in the A mode, that won't happen because the camera is adjusting the shutter speed to always make the exposure correct.
Well, correct as it decides is correct, but we're trying to take control.
Okay, but we're not at the stage where we're taking full manual control. We're at the stage where we're still trusting the camera's light meter. We're just choosing artistically how deep we want the depth of field to be. So if we hit a wall, it's going to be because we've gone to an extreme. Either it's dark and we're trying to take a photo as if it isn't dark, in which case no matter what way you twiddle with the dials, you're going to have to go to ridiculous high ISOs or you're just going to get nowhere. Or you've gone to a really shallow depth of field and the camera actually can't make the shutter go quick enough to make that work. So you're at F1.4, the sun is shining full power, you're outside, it's California, and the camera's going, oh my God, I have to get a shot with this much light? I'm at my lowest ISO. I'm taking the thing at 1/4000th of a second. Help!
So it'll blink.
It'll flash a warning at you. You can take the picture anyway. It won't stop you pressing the shutter, but it will come out too bright because it's going to go absolutely as quick as it can to make up for your desire to get this really, really shallow depth of field. But the laws of physics have kicked in, so you're going to get an overexposed photo. So you have to then begin to close up the aperture, let in a bit less light. So increase it to F2. Try again. F2.8. Try again. F4. You're probably not going to have to go any further than that. You're probably only going to have to go that far.
Okay, so to let
most
in,
of the time,
to
though,
let in less
in the,
light, I'm going to make that number get smaller or bigger?
Bigger. F1.4, you're at the extreme, so there's actually only one way you can turn the dial.
Okay.
And the other effect is going to happen the other way. You're trying to take a landscape shot, and you say, oh, I'm going to go at F64. And you try to take a picture, and there's nowhere near enough light to take a picture at F64. Then you just turn the dial the other way. You only run into this problem at the extremes, so you're going to know what way to turn the dial. Because you're at an extreme, so you go the other way.
Okay, so I mean, I guess I used a poor example by choosing an extreme. The real question would be when you're somewhere in the middle and it's not what you want. That's where I don't. That's where I go.
Okay, if it's somewhere
and I go
in the
back
middle,
and program.
If it's somewhere in the middle, the not what you want is going to be an artistic thing, not the laws of physics have gotten in the way. So in that case, what you're interested in is looking at it and going, is too much or too little in focus? If it's too little, increase the F number. If it's too much, decrease the F number till you're happy.
Okay.
And the nice thing with digital is you can keep doing it again and again and again.
So maybe what I'm remembering is how I freak out when I'm on full manual mode and there's too many degrees of freedom. You're saying this because
you have to take something else into account that we're going to get to in a moment.
Okay.
Aperture mode actually isn't that scary. Trust me.
Yeah, I think I haven't played in there enough, so maybe I'm going to be a little bold and I'll move into aperture.
Seriously, A is where my camera spends most of its time. Okay. I can use M, but A is actually an awful lot easier because what I care about most of the time is that controlling the depth of field. So I'm happy to let the camera mechanically fix everything else to make it match my depth of field.
Okay.
I do also never leave the ISO on auto because I hate noise.
Yeah.
So I take that control too, but that's my choice.
Okay, so I'm going to set that to 200 because you said that's the native ISO of our camera. There's a bunch of other options though too. I mean, there's AFA, our focus mode, and how it's choosing to focus and stuff like that.
I'm going to not cover that this week.
Maybe that'll be next week's show.
It's actually a really interesting topic, and I'd be delighted to cover it. It would really, really confuse things.
Okay,
today.
Yeah, let's skip that. Okay, good. Because I'm already confused.
That's aperture mode, and that is actually the one you normally care about. It has a partner, which is S, or shutter priority, which is exact the same as aperture priority, except that you take manual control over the shutter speed and let the camera adjust the aperture to match. And you do that when you want to mess with time. Basically, if something's moving and you want to control how that movement looks, click the camera to S. Sport would be a great example. Stick it to S and get it down to at least 1/400th of a second. 1,000th would be great, especially if you've zoom lens on. Crank it right down, take a test shot, see that everyone's sharp, and then leave it alone. Or you can go the other way with it. So let's say you have a waterfall and you want that silky smooth look. What you want then is as long an exposure as possible so the water has moved enough to become beautifully blurred. And that gives that silky effect. What you want to do then is manually set your shutter speed to the slowest you can get away with. If you have a tripod, you can go ridiculously slow. If you don't have a tripod, which many people don't, there's a little rule of thumb that's really good to know. So you have your lens, and it's going to be so many millimeters. It'll be written on a zoom lens. So the one that comes with our camera is an 18 to 30 to 55. As we turn it, you can see the numbers change. So at 55 millimeters, you can hold 1/155th of a second. At 18 millimeters, you can hold 1/18th of a second. At 200 millimeters, if you swap on your zoom, you can hold 1/200th of a second. See the pattern?
Yes.
So whatever the number of millimeters, 1 over that is how much you can hand hold.
I'm sorry to back you up, but here's one of the things where I get stuck here is just even figuring out how to tell it what speed to set the shutter speed to or how to set the aperture. So
you click that spinny dial into either A or S, we'll say S for now since that's what we're dealing with, there's a thumb wheel on the back of the camera. Mm-hmm. That's what moves it.
Well, so that's what I thought. So, of course, I've been playing while you've been talking, but I was on aperture priority, and I went into the little mode where you can see what you're doing. And as I turn it, the little diagram of the aperture gets bigger. When I go to the left, it gets smaller. When I go to the right, and so I'm not even looking at the numbers. I'm going, okay, I get it. Big hole. I'm going to get shallow depth of field.
Yeah.
Yay! So I switched it over
to
shutter.
It to S,
and the
and
same
then when you
thing
move that
changes.
Dial, the number changes.
Same thing's changing. I'm turning it, and that little hole picture is getting bigger or smaller.
Okay, but you're not controlling the hole. The hole is getting bigger or smaller to match your choice of shutter.
But I don't see where it's telling me the shutter. Maybe that's specific to my
so it's
camera.
The big number.
I see an F with a number next to it. Oh, but no, that's the... Well, I see 1 inch. It's got a little
that's
double quote. Oh, okay.
So turn the dial the other way. You should start to see more realistic numbers.
5.
That's 1/5th of a second.
8.
Keep turning.
13.
You'll eventually end up with normal land.
25, 30. It's yelling at me, subject is too dark.
Is your lens cap on?
I keep looking because it's acting like that, but no, it isn't.
Yeah, you were inside in a dark room, though.
I guess so. Okay, I'll point it at the window. Now it's a little happier. 200. Still says the subject's too dark. Now it says 400. Is that 1/400th of a second?
That's 1/400th. Now, if you were to take that, leave that setting there and move around to different rooms in the house with different levels of light, the 1/400th would not change, but you'd see the aperture setting compensate every time you went to a different level of brightness.
Oh, maybe that's how I can start to grok it, is by looking at that.
So if you put on aperture priority, the opposite will happen.
Mm-hmm.
You'll choose the size of the hole, and as you move from room to room with different levels of brightness, the other number will change, but the aperture will stay put.
Okay.
So basically, you're taking control of one, and the camera is controlling the other to make it work.
Okay.
And you just took a picture.
Yeah, I know. I figured you could probably tell that the whole time. I'm trying to understand you while you say it.
Sure. So in shutter priority, you're choosing, I don't care what the camera has to do to make this possible. I want this exposure to be 1/30th of a second. And if that means F8, so be it. If that means F64, so be it. I want 1/30th of a second.
And if it's 1/30th of a second, it's going to say 30 or it's going to say 0.333?
It's going to say 30.
Okay, because we're in upside down land.
We're in upside down land. Okay. And if you go to the extreme, so you go to a 2-second exposure, then you get the 2 with the little dash.
So why is it still telling me it's too dark?
Because you're inside.
No, maybe I'm going the wrong way. I see I'm still going the wrong way. I'm up to 4,000 and it's still saying it's too dark.
1/4,000th of a second is almost no time.
Okay, so I'm going backwards. So I'm saying barely open it for any time at all. That's why it's saying subject's too dark.
Yeah.
Okay. I got you. I'm pointed at an open window. Oh, there we go. At 1/30th, it's going to let it. It's not yelling at me that it's too dark.
If you wanted to actually take an accurate reading, you may need to have to press the shutter. So it's actually in focus when it's trying to measure the light.
Yeah.
Because if out of focus, light is always too dark.
Okay. Shutter priority is hard. I don't think I'm going to like this one.
Shutter priority, it's only for certain situations. It's only for if you care about speed. So if you want to take a panning shot, you know the way where you'd have someone cycling by on a bike and they're really sharp but the background is blurred?
Mm-hmm.
You do that by just saying, okay, I have an 18mm lens, so I can manage to handhold about 1/20th of a second. Dial shutter priority, set 1/20th of a second, and just follow the person on the bike with the camera and hold down the shutter. And then they'll be sharp and the background will be blurred.
Why would the background be blurred?
You're moving.
You're saying I'm actually rotating. You're saying in that 1/20th of a second, I'm actually going to move the camera?
Yeah. You just worry about keeping the camera on the bike and keep pressing the shutter. I just take shots, one shot after the other. Half of them, maybe even 2/3 of them.
Probably look like crap.
But when you manage to actually move at the same speed as the bike will be sharp because it's not moving, and the background will be blurred because you're moving.
So you have to look at how much you've zoomed it first. So if I've got it at 55, that means I can only hold it at 1/60th.
Exactly. Ooh. And depending on how much caffeine you've had, perhaps 1/80th.
I'm reminded of the last time I tried to take a picture of a bicyclist going by was when we were up in the wine country here with Dean and Suzanne, and we're driving at 50 miles an hour, and I'm in the passenger seat holding my digital SLR up through the sunroof, trying to even guess where the bicyclists are. I took about 60 pictures. I think I got 2, and they weren't very good.
Yeah, well, digital is your friend. Imagine doing that with a film camera where every click costs you money.
Oh, yeah.
So the other thing, of course, you can do is keep the camera still and have something move through the frame. So maybe you want light trails of a train passing through your shot. Mm-hmm. You still need a long shutter speed because otherwise the train is going to be sharp and you want it blurry. So you want to take control. Or you want to make sure that the person running is sharp, then you take control the other direction. But if you care about something that's moving and you care about how the motion looks, shutter priority is your friend.
So that's a perfect example of where there's no way even using the little dial with the running man or something could work, because you're kind of saying, yeah, it's a running man, but blur him, which is the opposite.
Well, yeah,
there's no way it could know what
you meant.
You're
making an artistic choice. So you got to take control and actually make the artistic choice.
So to be honest,
A and S, aperture and shutter, are the most important modes to get to know.
Well, that
Going
makes
on
me
to
feel
full
better.
Manual
I don't need to go
great.
To the 4-diamond slope then. I think I've been trying to jump straight to manual mode.
Right. I'm comfortable in manual mode. I use it from time to time, and I'll explain why I use it sometimes. But I don't use it all the time because it's more work. When all I care about is the aperture, I'll just use A mode because that lets me tell the camera the bit I care about. Or if I want to have fun with motion blur and stuff, I'll stick it to S mode because the only thing I care about is getting that motion blur the way I want. So to be honest, I would guess 95% or more of the time my camera is in either A or S.
Okay.
And I'm really comfortable in full manual. But why make life hard for yourself?
Yeah. Okay, well, good. Well, maybe I can stand this then.
Okay, so that is the most important point.
Okay.
Right? The last one, I'll be quick, is full manual. So
no,
all of these things
not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
You don't have to do it often, but sometimes you might be happy you can. all of everything we've done so far works for one reason. The camera has a little doohickey inside it that measures light. It's called the light meter. And it uses that to do all of its calculations. So it knows what ISO the camera's at. It knows what aperture you want. It knows how much light there is, so it knows what shutter speed to set to make it all work. If you take it to full manual, the light meter isn't making any more decisions for you.
Yeah.
You've taken it all on, but very kindly, the camera will show you the light meter. So if you look through the eyepiece, there'll be a little
scale. Mode now?
Hmm?
In manual mode?
In full manual mode, if you look through the eyepiece, there'll be a little scale, which will have dots. When you get the value right, it'll be at zero. If the dots are to the right, it means you're too dark. If the dots are to the left, it means you're too bright.
When I get what right? Any of the three things.
Any of the three things. When you manage to get the three things into a working combination. And there are an infinite number of those at any point. To be honest,
I'm just turning the dial in because I don't know which one I'm changing now. And that dotted thing is flinging from right to left by four dots. So to either side of zero. Yeah. So I'm not going to do this.
The only time I use it is because light meters are sometimes fooled. So you know, I'm fond of trains. You've probably heard that.
That's come up.
Yeah. So I will, if I want to really get a picture of a train, and I don't want it to be messed up. I will go out. And I will be there early, so something special is coming, a steam train or something cool. I will go out, I will use aperture priority, and I will read off the numbers. I will then click the camera to manual and program in those numbers. Because the moment the train comes with its giant big headlight, light meter is going to go, oh my god, it's so bright, I must change everything.
Ah.
And the photograph will be wrong. So I take my measurements using aperture priority before the train comes, read the values, click it to manual, dial in the values, and then the camera can't change anything. And then I just take the picture.
Nice. So I think if I were a real woman, though, I'd also put it in manual focus to make sure nothing I take a picture of looks any good at all.
Well, you can use the focus lock. We'll get into that another day.
No. That's too scary. All right, Bart. Well, I actually think I am a step closer. I've done this about, like I said, 26 times. And what I think I really need to do is take my friend Victor up on... not Victor Kahiawa, a different Victor... take him up on his offer to go out on a photo shoot with him where we play with it. And he says, okay, see how that did this. And then you do this. And, but for now, I think I'm going to try aperture priority for a little while and just see if I can get used to that.
Aperture is the most important because that's where you can be the most creative.
Okay, cool.
And the only way to learn is take squillions of pictures.
All right. Well, I am good at squillions. I'm quite good at that, but I'm learning, I'm pretty darn good at barting too.
Excellent.
All right, Bart. Well, we've gone on for quite some time here, but this really helps me. I hope everybody else got a little bit of knowledge here on this.
And as I say, if we went too fast, I hope the blog post is a help to people.
I think it will.
Cool. Business as usual next week?
I believe so.
Excellent. Until then, happy computing.
Well, that's going to wind up this week's show. I want to warn you that in the near future, I'm going to be doing the live show at an earlier hour. You see, the Brits have been asking for a show where normal people can stay awake. I can't keep it early, though, because I just don't get things done that early. That'd be hard. But I'm going to try to do it at least once in the near future. So keep tuned to my Twitter feed. I'll give you plenty of notice when I'm going to do that. In the meantime, head on over to the live show on what is commonly known as 5 p.m. Sunday nights where Allison lives. This doesn't give you the barest clue of what time it is where you live. I've been saying GMT minus 8 for a long time, but I've just been convinced by quality control director Steve that during daylight savings time, it's actually GMT minus 7. I thought I could get away with saying, let me just say 5 p.m. PST. Turns out that's not right either, because it's 5 p.m. PDT, because it's daylight saving time. Oh, and he also corrected me from saying daylight savings time. It's daylight saving time. Anyway, this means I have no clue what time it is where you live. I suggest you get TimeScroller from timescroller.com for the Mac or iPhone/iPod Touch. Then set one time to Los Angeles, California, and the other time to where you live. Drag the little scroller till it says 5 p.m. at my house, and then look to see what time it is at your house. Now, are we all clear? Okay, now where do you go when it's 5 p.m. on my house on Sunday? At least that part's easy. Just go to podfeed.com/live. It's a ton of fun in there. It's a family-friendly environment. Well, as long as Ahern isn't there, and they welcome newcomers. we had a bunch of newcomers this time. We had, let's see, we had the boss was here and, oh, where did he go? Oh, shoot. I can't remember his name. It had Mo in the title and, he was new too. Looks like he left and we had Svenlor. Oh, apparently Bruce Springsteen was here as well, according to Victor. Anyway, it's a lot of fun in there. Like I said, family friendly, and I really encourage you to give it a try. Until then, keep the dumb questions and comments coming by sending them along to Allison@podfeet.com. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.